Our text is taken from Romans 12, 1 and 2, which you're well familiar with. You know, my grandmother usually wrote this in her manna, greetings to brethren. In fact, it was a large factor in my counting the cost of consecration. We usually think of this in connection with that which is holy and acceptable and with justification. Otherwise, in connection with a reasonable service, which is appropriate to compare with the transitory cost of this life to eternity. But today, we want to consider the aspect of be ye transformed. Today, we are not what we were yesterday, and we are not what we will be tomorrow. You know, we were all born with scripts or paradigms in our minds, and I believe some were formed in the very chromosomes, the genetics with which we were born, at least with some weaknesses, some propensities or predispositions, even for diseases and for infection, a malady or even some affliction or deformity. These began more than 6,000 years ago after Eden, when impaired genes passed their flaws to the next generation. But there's a very interesting aspect of the mind and the brain. Even at birth, there are neurons that are connecting one to another, and they can map these like a big spider web of electronics connecting one point to another. There's something that happens shortly after birth that the researchers call pruning, that breaks some of these connections. And some of this is done by the environment, the very sounds that a baby hears, the temperatures, the whole environment of the home, and emphasizing and building other connections and neurons. So we see that there's a great deal of environmental aspect to what happens in the mind and the brain that marked us for our formative youth. These came from peers, those we respected, and yet perhaps sowed some criticism in our little minds. And then we lived with them for the rest of our lives. It may have come from an overworked or insensitive teacher who told us we could not read or do math because we were lazy. Or we were told, you will never be able to do that. And so these scripts are also passed from parent to child, often unintentionally, because children have the example of their parents, and they from their forefathers, and they from eventually Adam and Eve. Yet occasionally there is one like an Isaac Newton or an Albert Einstein who reach beyond their fathers and their peers to examine history and test the universe for answers to old paths and new horizons, new synapses, new connections, new motives that were not there even naturally. Still, even the wisdom of some of these wise men of old was limited by their humanity. Let us first examine the flaws of the old nature. And to recognize these flaws is the first step to repair them. After examining a few of the flaws of which we all have, we want to examine how to be transformed and changed to build new paths, new resolutions, and a new nature. You know, a child may be told the reason he cannot make friends is because he is just shy. Or other kids pick on you because you are weak and timid. They are only bullies. And so now he sees his peers as overbearing, invincible, and himself as somewhat vulnerable. Otherwise, a parent may tell him, Don't let him walk all over you. Just push him back and tell him who's boss. And so one script forms in one mind to be timid and in another mind to be an intimidator. Even more debilitating is to always be told, it's not your fault. You're right. I'll fix it for you. That child learns to avoid accountability for his actions and repair his own mistakes. Others told us that your sufferings are because they did wrong, not you. Well, we would not attribute every personality, dear brethren, to such trivial beginnings and impressions in our lives. Yet such things are reinforced through our lives, or how we read many of the circumstances around us. While we all have a choice to change, many never do. These are patterns of the flesh that, if persisted in, will inhibit the transformation process that exists in the school of Christ. The human nature is most manifest in adverse conditions. There's a tendency to be excessively compliant at every turn. There are conflicts of interest, procedure, opinions regarding truth and error. This may lead to appeasing and apologizing and yielding to the ideas and preferences of others, only discover that we would have been much better to develop our own basis of confidence, regardless of popular opinion. The other extreme is to contend and debate every matter, great or small, with a view of prevailing and convincing another person. Soon you'll find that's impossible. But whether you are right or wrong is not proven by silencing your opponent. Truth is found in the word and mind of God, and there we need to be content. Truth left at the gate may open a door, where debate will find only a wall. It may seem strange, but some contention or dissension is born even of our feelings of insecurity or lack of conviction over the substance of what we have assented to. We may characterize another's ideas as ridiculous. This places the other person on the defensive. Before they can gather their wits to reply and let us escape with some substance of being right. In reality, though, all truth is important to understand as clearly as we possibly can. While contending, that is, struggling earnestly for the faith, Jude verse 3, we are not to be contentious about these matters. There are those things I consider that are rock solid and immovable, such as the ransom and restitution, Christ's return, the covenants, the sin offering. Yet history and prophecy are also provided for the church. I consider Bible chronology as complete, and also the visions of Daniel and the promises to Israel and the Great Pyramid, which has firm foundations. Yet even while holding these convictions, there are other matters that must allow for some spaces between the substance of things. Some subjects generate much discussion among the brethren, including the four winds, Gog and Magog, and unwalled villages, the image of the beast and the false prophet, or just how the seven last plagues occur, or Elijah's chariot, the horses, the fire, the wind. Listening with due consideration to others on such matters enables, at least for myself, the gleaning of some details and perspectives to confirm or expand my own understanding. Now there are some other matters of problems, some nagging matters on our old nature. One of them is anger and wrath. We may even justify our outburst as righteous indignation, as was Jesus casting out the money changers. But our anger is seldom so righteously based as his. It often arises when others frustrate our plans, impose on our time and resources, or misrepresent our motives. Sometimes we give them a tongue lashing, or otherwise just let it burn within our own minds and emotions. I'm reminded of one time leaving a grocery store when they had those double doors. When a man was going ahead, and he just let the doors fall behind in my face. Anger called out for him to have a little consideration. When he turned around, I saw that he was blind, struggling himself to find his way out. Ephesians 4:31. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice. We want to touch on another element of our old nature. That is that which relates to giving and receiving offenses. There are times we are either too sensitive or we are too insensitive. One may be critical of another's lifestyle or their preferences or their opinions, where it is not upon us to set everyone straight about everything, any more than it is up to them to advise, monitor, and correct our personal choices. But if the matters were morals and principles, conduct that affect others, and especially our families and ecclesia, then of course it's a different matter. Principles must always prevail. Principles are God's rules for living. But it is often a little difference that brings big offenses. There are customs, traditions, priorities, and preferences where we have no business tampering or tinkering with the lives of others. Often we reason that my principles are only your preferences, or vice versa. Well, we are sometimes on the receiving side of offenses from others, and sometimes we are on the side of giving those offenses. We should develop a little thicker skin over the offenses that we receive. And perhaps sometimes we can say, "Brother, thank you for your concern. I think it's a matter for me to handle this matter." Then there are other matters of maneuvering and manipulating others to serve our own agenda. Some are born whiners in this world and never seem to grow out of it. They complain, they coax, or they cajole others to serve or fix their wish lists. Sometimes their importuning pushes others to yield and to give them what they wish. Do they first think how they might have handled it for themselves? Yet frequent pleas come with, "Can you do this for me?" when they need to at least be part of the solution. If you ask someone to call or write another person to provide something for you, at least ask ourselves, is it possible to do it for ourselves directly? Perhaps it is only easier or less troublesome by asking another to do it than yourself. Of course, sometimes we have reached the end of our limits, and that is true. In that case, let our requests be genuine. Another matter I'd like to raise, and that is the matter of giving and receiving. This is seldom thought of as a problem. As children, we learned it is good to give and a joy to receive. What could possibly be a complication in such a matter? Well, we might be giving of that which we do not have, or we should have met personal responsibilities before giving. We might be giving to be covering for some other inadequacy, or a bit like a sin offering, but without correcting the cause. We might give mainly with a hope or expectation of return or reciprocation. In fact, we may feel rather indignant if we have not been acknowledged. Here is the problem. Yet it is more godlike to give when we are not known as the giver, or even when we are not thanked, to give freely. Luke chapter 6, beginning with verse 30, we'll extract just a few comments for the time. Give to every man that asketh of thee, and of him that taketh away thy goods, ask them not again. And if ye lend to them of whom ye hope to receive, what thank have ye? For sinners also lend to sinners, to receive as much again. But love ye your enemies, and do good unto them, do good and lend, hoping for nothing again. But nevertheless, if we are on the receiver side, how blessed it is to acknowledge our unworthiness and our gratitude for such things so much more than we ever deserve. Do not think of ourselves as being deserving. But this is not the way of the flesh, which often considers ourselves as more worthy than what we have, or regard bounties that we do receive as some kind of a free windfall or something that drops at our feet without our labor, and then we begin to hoard it. Brethren, it is better to have the spirit of a giver and then give even more to another. Pass it on from the abundance of the great giver of every good and perfect gift. Brethren, there are so many other areas of the flesh born or instilled into these bodies. We might speak about rationalization, about excuses, diversions, indulgences, health, mental and physical, family, possessions, fears, talents, or the lack of them, poverty or wealth. And the list goes on with these matters of the flesh. But all these are matters that will pass when this brief life passes. So now I want to use the rest of our time about being transformed. How do we transform these paradigms, the synapses that were built into our brains and our families and our minds? What is there to say about being transformed from and to what? All the difficulties we mentioned relate to the flesh, and from which most persons change very little, even in 100 years. But for the new creation, it is different. And you know it is different. It is rather like that caterpillar described in the sixth volume, page 193, compressed in its cocoon to escape in due course with the wings of an emperor. You are not now what you will be. It is forming even now in the inner thoughts of your mind. And it is in those thoughts and temperament that will soon be born on wings of the morning when the shadows flee away. The first tool that we have at our resource is prayer. And prayer is a resource that is unknown to most of humanity. It takes resolve. If we come to the throne of heavenly grace, there is a request. It must be sincere. And it is our desire to change, to be more like our Master, to use the tools that He's put into our hands, to be forgiven for our mistakes. Use prayer. We want to give you some rules of thought that will guide us through the diversities of the flesh. For we cannot possibly find clear procedures that will answer every difficulty. But we can find some guidelines, some general rules. And these are the principles that will lift us above affliction and the thorns in our flesh. The first rule is found in Romans 12, that Romans 12 text. Present your bodies a living sacrifice. The new creation will never be transformed by simply loving righteousness while still holding to the flesh with a positive grip with the other hand. The lesson is in the memorial symbol of breaking the bread. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 16. The bread which we break, is it not the participation in the body of Christ? 2 Timothy 2, verse 11. For if we be dead with Him, we shall also live with Him. You may remember the consecration card found in the possession of Brother Benjamin Barton upon his early death in 1916 at 41 years of age. The consecration card was dated 1895 when he was 21 years old. And it read, I disclaim all right to myself, from henceforth to my soul, to my body, my time, my wealth, health, my reputation, my talents, or anything that belongs to me. I confess myself to be the property of my glorious Redeemer. I dedicate myself to Him to serve, love, and trust Him as my life and my salvation to my life's end, which finished in 1916, 3 months before Brother Russell died. So what have we to preserve here of status or reputation or honor of men, wealth or fame? Otherwise, at best, you will see no more than the wise men of earth ever saw. Our purpose is not to ask, what must I do, but how can I serve? How can I use more of this little life to serve and honor Him and His? Only when this is clearly in our minds will the horizons of truth begin to be seen. Sacrifice. The second rule we would mention is humility. Humbly submitting to the chiseling of the divine architect in the school of Christ. You know, the sculptor Michelangelo was once asked how he knew how to cut a block of marble. And he replied that he stands for a long time before the uncut stone until I see the stone, in the stone, the image that is in my mind. And then I work furiously to remove anything that does not belong to that image. Careful not to damage anything that is within. But if the stone resists, all is lost. Paul said in Galatians 4, verse 19, My little children of whom I travail in birth, again until Christ be formed in you. Christ is the sculpture. You are the clay. You know, it has become customary in universities for students to assert their own ideas and challenge every precept of the professor. But this is not the way it is in the school of Christ. We listen to the teacher and connect with every evidence of his sacred lessons. He says in Matthew 11, verse 29, "Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly of heart, and ye shall find rest in your souls." Now moving on, there is a companion principle to humility, and yet is perfectly compatible. This is the idea of decisions and courage and perseverance and strength. Once a lesson is understood, it must be used with persistence. It does no good to say, Once I had a lesson that I understood, but there's no way that I can use the rules in my life with my limitations, with my experiences, with my situation. Brethren, if we don't use the lessons that we learn, the instructions are of no more value than the paper on which they are written. Jesus said in John 6, verse 63, "The words that I speak unto you, they are spirit and they are life. Use them. Not just if you hear them, and not even if you understand them, but if you do them." In the January 3 manna text, Brother Russell speaks of overcoming our natural preferences, whether it is a matter of awakening in the morning, reading and studying, finishing a duty or a project that has begun, a service, a sacrifice, or even an apology. We have a choice just to do it and to change. But this takes force in the mind to build a new path, a new resolve, a pattern that will continue. And this takes courage to go against the stream, sometimes charting new waters. It takes great courage. It took great courage for Columbus to venture beyond the charts of human mind. Consider the poem in Poems of Dawn, page 152, titled Heroism. In this respect, the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, but to him that endures to the end. This leads us to another element of transformation, and that is to think in another dimension. You know, we may even memorize the books of men. And if we do, we understand no more and perhaps even less than they did when they wrote them. But when you read the Word of God, you are getting close to His mind. One might imagine the idea. Try to picture this in your mind. If you're trying to follow the path of someone through the forest, and you are trying to read their signposts, looking behind the trees, under the rocks, the footprints of their paths and direction. It's a very difficult process to interpret the course when you're in the middle of the trees. Now imagine yourself in an airplane, 33,000 feet above the earth, 10,000 kilometers above the earth, with a perfectly clear telescope, and you see the trails and the paths that lead some to nowhere. And then you see other paths and some trails that lead through valleys and over mountains to a new city. All we're saying is you need to get above the trees. You need to see the big picture. You need to see as God sees, through the eyes of the prophets and the apostles and the teachers. And then we understand the details, and we need new glasses to see the entire plan and how to chart each path that leads nowhere and those that lead somewhere. Look down from above. Only by first seeking the whole grand plan can we begin to understand the parts. Some make the mistake of first microanalyzing the parts before seeing the big picture, the whole, and how each part conforms to the whole. But when you see the whole picture, the grand plan, and then you look down to the parts and see the beautiful details of how they harmonize, you know which direction to go. Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians 2, verse 7 through 16, and again we'll read only part. We impart a secret and hidden wisdom of God, which God decreed before the ages for our glory. So also no one comprehends the thoughts of God except the Spirit of God. The natural person does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are folly to him, but we have the mind of Christ. This was from the English Standard Version. Now this rule of thinking in a new dimension is coupled with seeing with and through the eyes of those with spiritual vision who have gone before us. Listening to and reading the historians of this world is one thing, but spiritual teachers is quite another. You know them when you hear them, and you could begin with the messengers to the church, the seven churches. Then there were the records of the apostles and the disciples. Then there were the prophets and patriarchs that were before them. From here you can expand your own list. You will know the sound and spirit when you hear it, and you will know the voice of one that is a shepherd and one that is not a shepherd. When you want to read and understand and be transformed, I will suggest four questions. These should go beyond merely repeating what they say. First, ask yourself, why did they write this? What was their motive? Second, what is the evidence, the basis, or proof for this? Third, what harmony and consistency and beauty does it bring to the whole plan of God? And fourth, how can I benefit and use what I am hearing? These will build new paths through this new mind. It seems our Lord has touched each one of us with some mentor or example of the Christian life. Some of them are now taken from us so we can stand on our own and that we might pass the torch of truth and the Spirit to another generation. So let us copy the noble examples in our lives and follow them as they followed Christ. Now I want to talk a little about the transforming power of trials. It is the fire in the crucible that brings forth the gold. There are so many things we didn't anticipate when we began the Christian journey. How could we have possibly known? Some of us thought that in our youth, the finish and the victory will be complete in a few short years. But after 50 and 60 years and more, some of us are still here. And the trials become larger and larger and heavier and heavier. Paul said, looking back in 2 Corinthians 11, verses 23 to 28, again from the English Standard Version, and I will extract just a few words. I am talking like a madman, with far greater labors, far more imprisonments, and countless beatings, and often near death. And he concludes by saying, and apart from all other things, there is the daily pressure on me and my anxiety for all the churches. I wonder if he saw or anticipated any of this when he was stopped on his way to Damascus with a vision of the Lord in his eyes that burned and his ears that heard the words, "Why persecutest thou me, Paul?" Or Saul? Or how much he would suffer for Christ? Did he know? How could he have ever known the difficulties that lay before him? How could we have ever known when we laid our lives before him, as did Brother Barton? Was Paul ever depressed or discouraged? Was he? I know of none of those who ever survived the weight of this world who never felt discouraged or cast down and sometimes helpless and even fearful in the valley of the shadow of death, with its fierce creatures, visible and invisible, enemies within and without. Yet the truly noble characters did not stop there to lie down and die at the hand of the enemy, nor quench the spirit that began this journey. It is no defeat to feel pain and the trials. It is not a defeat to be discouraged, but it is a defeat to give up the ship in the middle of the storm and to let it sink. Sometimes, brethren, we are the victims. Other times we create our own problems and trials, and yet we may only think of ourselves as the victims, and sometimes we are part of the problem. If we are to prevail, our thinking and attitude about them must change. Whether we participated in the cause or not, we must change. Albert Einstein once said, "We cannot solve problems by using the same kind of thinking we used when we created them." We must change our thinking. We must be transformed. The only way to escape and conquer the trials is to stand above it and refuse to be its victim. The new creature is more precious than all our afflictions and must use the very trials as stones to climb up higher and higher. Benjamin Barton also drew a little picture for his sister in about 1906, in which one man lies crushed below an immense stone. Beside him is another stone next to a series of steps. Upon it stands a woman lifted nearly halfway toward the steps leading to glory, honor, and immortality. And he writes a little inscription below this picture: "We may live above our trials or beneath them. Where do you live?" It is in accord with this that we read in the manna of December the 9th, and we'll read that, leave that for your reading. Read December 9th manna. In closing, brethren, we have considered the flesh from which we are transformed. We have considered prayer, sacrificial consecration, humility and submission, courage, faith, perseverance, and decisions, spiritual vision, and perspectives, the proper use of teachers, the transforming influence by trials.